Ready for a gut check? Stick around. Let's talk about it.
Houston, we have a problem.
Habemos Papam.
Podcasting from a parking lot in the Woodlands, Texas, it's the Catholic Hack with Joe McClain.
Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body, which will be given up for you.
1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give an explanation to anyone who asks you for a reason for your hope.
Take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is the cup of my blood, the blood of the new and everlasting covenant. It will be shed for you and for all, so that sins may be forgiven.
The Church of the Living God, the pillar and foundation of truth. 1 Timothy 3:15.
Do this in memory of me.
Welcome back to the Catholic Hack. I'm Joe McClain. This is episode number 46. And today we're going to continue our discussion with Tarek Saab about Gut Check, his new book on his life, his journey through his profession, and his journey through his faith. And I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. And I know it sounds like a shameless plug, but you know what? I really did enjoy this book. And I think that all men, just about my age, maybe a little older, a little younger, you're going to get a lot out of this book. You're going to feel like this was your journey too. And that's why I really loved having the opportunity to talk with Tarek about this book. How is your Lent going? Mine is still pretty much a struggle. Still trying to catch up. Still trying to weed my way through it. It's been just too busy, and I've had the flu and now the bronchitis. So it's just been a struggle, and I wish I could start over. But you know what? I've been blessed to have Scott Hahn breaking the bread. So let's do that now. Let's break the bread with Dr. Scott Hahn.
In these last days of Lent, we experience the healing that comes with penance and sacrifice. Yet Jesus wants us to focus on a still greater work to be done, a work He will accomplish with our resurrection. That's good news in this week's Mass. Find out more next on Breaking the Bread. As we draw near to the end of Lent, our gospel clearly has Jesus' passion and death in view. That's why John gives us the detail about Lazarus' sister Mary, that she is the one who anointed the Lord for burial. His disciples warn against returning to Judea. Thomas even predicts they will die with him if they go back. When Lazarus is raised, John notices the tombstone being taken away, as well as Lazarus' burial cloths and head covering, all details he later notices with Jesus' empty tomb. Like the blind man in last week's readings, Lazarus represents all humanity. He stands for dead man, for all those Jesus loves and wants to liberate from the bands of sin and death. John even recalls the blind man in his account today. Like the man's birth in blindness, Lazarus' death is used by Jesus to reveal the glory of God. And again, like last Sunday, Jesus' words and deeds both give sight to those who believe. If we believe, we will see. We will see that Jesus loves each of us, just as he loved Lazarus, that he calls us out of death and into new life. By his resurrection, Jesus has fulfilled Ezekiel's promise in this week's first reading. He has opened the graves that we may rise. He has put his spirit in us that we may live. This is the spirit that Paul writes about in our epistle. The same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead will give life to us who were once dead in sin. Faith is the key. If we believe, as Martha does in today's gospel, that Jesus is the resurrection and the life, even if we die, we will live. God the Father assures us in this Sunday's first reading, I have promised and I will do it. So we must trust in His word as we sing in the psalm that with Him is forgiveness and salvation. This is Scott Hahn for Breaking the Bread.
Breaking the Bread is a production of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. If you'd like to receive written copies of Dr. Hahn's reflections on the Sunday Mass readings, you can contact us by email at staff@salvationhistory.com or call us at 740-264-9535. That's 740-264-9535.
You know, this particular passage about Lazarus rising from the dead reminds me of Adam and how he was the first coward, how he refused to be that man of principle who stood in the gap between Satan and his wife Eve. He allowed his wife to face this bully all by herself, to face the Nahash, the dragon, you know, and the serpent, when he should have stood there and been the man in the gap, the man of principle, knowing that if he would have died, even if Satan would have taken his life, that God would have raised him from the dead, just like Lazarus. Lazarus is the foreshadowing that points us towards the new Adam, as St. Paul puts it, the Christ, Jesus himself, who gives up his life and is raised from the dead. And that's what we're all called to, especially as men. Ephesians 5 makes that clear. St. Paul tells us, as men, we must be prepared to lay down our life. And that's just the same as gut check, when Tarek said that's the man he wanted to be, the man of principle. So you know what? Let's roll up our sleeves and let's dive deep and get into the truth with Tarek Saab.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
This school, when I sit, even just a little bit, I get hit with the power that made the veil in the temple split. When I submit, fall on the floor and adore. Can't get enough, got to come back for some more.
Hey, we've got a problem here.
Sinner, every human in the free can benefit in this school. Repent and commit.
Roger that.
As the incense rises up in adoration of the throne, something happens to my wounded heart from all the love revealed and shown. Bright light, Shekinah comes to my aid to assist. To change and sustain the way I think it exists. To feel the bliss because my name is in the book of life's list. That's what happens when you sit in the school of the Eucharist.
Mr. Hammond, take her down. Make your depth 150 feet, 10 degree down, Bubba.
150 feet, 10 degree down, Bubba. Aye, sir.
Dive.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I think you're dead on point with men need to call other men, and it kind of reminds me of something you said a little bit earlier in the conversation when you're talking about being in the military and, you know, the glamour of, you know, going to war and you know, being involved in this conflict. I have a Belloc quote that I opened the book with that says, you know, all men have an instinct for conflict, at least right. All healthy men.
Right.
And, you know, later on in the book, you know, I quote a passage from Matthew that I just think is dead on point. It says, you know, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, mm-hmm. and it is the violent who bear it away. And, you know, we say, well, come on, I mean, this is the Bible. You know, we don't preach violence in the Bible, but what type of violence is he talking about? Well, not a physical violence.
Right.
It's a spiritual violence against our own perversity.
Right.
And that's the way that we need to look at our challenge as men when we call other men is, we have to be violent. We have to be spiritually violent in separating ourselves from our addictions, in separating ourselves from, you know, our fear, mm-hmm. in building this bank of courage within us that will enable us to confront the culture and to recruit other men. You know, it's an uncomfortable position to be in to be a Catholic today.
Right.
It is not easy at all to be Catholic. And in order to embrace our mission and to really live out our Catholic heritage, we have got to do violence against ourselves and against the culture.
It's so important. And, you know, with most men, in my experience, is men are, when the men realize that they are cowardly, especially, for example, just to pray. I felt this way when I went through a conversion experience. I realized I needed to pray. I realized I wanted to pray, but I realized I didn't have a clue as to how to pray. And I was embarrassed to pray with my family because I felt like I would look like an idiot, and no man wants to look like an idiot. They don't want to appear as is inadequate in front of women. So I felt that way in front of my wife. So I was scared. I avoided opportunities to pray with my wife because I felt like I didn't know how to pray.
Right.
And so a big part of what I always try to encourage men is, and I think you really made this point in your book through your sharing of your experience, is it's not the fact that we have to be perfect. We don't have to be scholars in our faith, theologians. We don't have to be very well read. We don't even have to be able to quote chapter and verse in the Bible. We simply have to try. We simply have to, you know, make an attempt every single day and then realize that that we're building in faith and we gain more courage and we have, you know, a better ability to try harder the very next day. And the biggest attack Satan will put on us, men, is to the ego. You know, you don't even know your own faith. Why try? You're a sinner, man. You just looked at that woman walking down the street. You don't really believe what you say. Why try? You know, and we take these blows and it breaks us down, and then we keep telling ourselves, well, it's all hypocrisy, why do we begin? But it's right. Not. It's the fact that we are, if we're honest with ourselves, we just need to get back up and just keep going on, keep moving forward. And that's a big thing with men. I think that they're just too easily let down because of their own they're being honest with themselves that they're not up to the task, so that they figure, why try? It's a mountain, so why climb it? You know, but again, men just need to try. I think if they just said to themselves, today I'm just going to make the attempt and let God be responsible for the success, I think there would be a world of difference. And I think that's kind of what you shared with me in this book, you know, in your experiences, that you fell down many a times. You realized early on, you know, you sought the divine, you sought truth, you encountered Aquinas and Aristotle, and then now we come past a scene in the club and we're seeing you having to reevaluate your whole life. You're living with other guys, and you clean out your room. You're starting to take an account for your life, and yet you're still not detached from your life. You're still having to encounter everyday work. You're still having to encounter your roommates and all that they're still doing, and you haven't got it all figured out yet. But again, we still see you sort of struggling forward instead of backward, and I think that's a pivotal change as well.
Yeah, and it's also trying to get the point across that, you know, changing your life, it's impossible to do it all in one fell swoop. You know, it's like maybe going cold turkey in some respects. You know, it's a step-by-step process. In fact, it's a step-by-step process that never ends until the day that you die.
Right.
But, you know, it's making the very first step is, you know, the most important act that you can make, because once you can really control one aspect of your life, let's say, for example, it's, you know, getting drunk. Say, hey, you know, the first step in correcting my vices is to no longer get drunk anymore. Well, once you got that under control, now what's the next thing that maybe we can take a look at? Maybe you're working on Sundays. Get that out of the picture. You know, it's, you know, I think one of the things I try to do in the book is let people know that for me, my journey has been, you know, long and arduous. It's not, it hasn't been, you know, the gut check isn't the Hollywood moment where, you know, someone dies of cancer, all of a sudden I'm a different guy.
Right.
You know, it's the gut check is, oh my gosh, man, I'm living not the life that I want to live. Well, how do I correct it, man? That's the hard part. That is the hard part, step by arduous step.
You know, and another point that I wanted to make earlier that, got lost, but and I still want to bring it up, is I appreciated the fact that you incorporated points in this book of the rap music. I think our generation, you know, back in the 90s, rap music really came to the scene. You know, Dr. Dre's album Chronic was huge, and when I went to boot camp and I went into the military, I wasn't listening to rap music really. I was into a different kind of music, you know, from a different background. But when I got to the military, everybody was listening to it. It was new to me. I'd go to the clubs. That's what they were playing. And I don't think people appreciate enough just how much of an impact that's had on our generation. And a damaging effect. I mean, and so when you incorporated those into this book, I appreciated that. Now, as I get older and more mature, you know, I obviously don't listen to rap music anymore. It's not that by itself, its medium is not bad, but it's been used by and large for, you know, illicit purposes. And there is a positive effect. I mean, I play in this podcast a chorus from a rap song from Father Stan Fortuna called School of the Eucharist. And I get questions. Why do you play that rap song? Listen to the words. It's the most energetic, positive message, you know, that I could play to you right now. In a nutshell, it talks about the power of sitting in adoration and the conversion experience as a result of that. That is a great great way to demonstrate the positive use of rap music and how that medium, which is very energetic, very excitable, can be used for God's glory in a very great way. And just recently, one of the listeners emailed me and said, you know, my sons are into rap music and I'm scared and I'm not, you know, really particularly happy about it and I don't really want them to listen to it, but can you make some recommendations to me? You know, and I was very pleased to be able to share with her some, you know, resources where she can go and maybe share some very positive rap music, you know, with her sons, and maybe they'll have a different effect. Maybe it'll have a different effect. Maybe it'll give them an opportunity to see, you know, the upside to that style of music instead of the very negative downside that you know, dopamine hook that I was, you know, exposed to and you were as well. So I just wanted to tell you that I appreciated that you put those in there. I think a lot of people don't really understand the effects of rap music too well.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, because there's many people who listen to this podcast or who will even read your book who probably have never liked rap music, but also
right.
at the same time don't understand the effects of it. So I thought you did a good job about adding those in there.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'll tell you this too, just like you, Joe, I never listen to rap music anymore. And, you know, I mean, popular rap music. And,
right.
and the reason for that is I loved rap music. I mean, I had every Eminem album, you know, Dr. Dre, Tupac, everything. I loved it. And even when I was going through my conversion, right, or I don't like to even call it a conversion because it's not like I was a different religion. It was more like getting out of my lukewarmness, you know?
Right, yeah.
One of the goals that I set for myself was to stop listening to that music because every single song was adulterated with vulgarity.
Right.
You know, it was talking about sex and women and booze and every other word is a swear word. And, you know, that's just not the type of, you know, information that I want to put in my head. My wife hates the fact that I still know all the words and all the lyrics to almost every rap song, you know, that I used to listen to
right.
it during that time period because it's just a waste of space in my
right.
head. But, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about the steps along the journey, the arduous
mm-hmm.
steps. You know, if I want to be a good Catholic man, that requires making sacrifices and making choices. And,
right.
you know, I don't think that St. Paul would listen to Tupac. I just don't. You know, I don't think that St. Francis would listen to Eminem. I don't. And, you know, I want to be like them. I want
right.
to be like the saints. And I have to, you know, adjust my life accordingly.
You know, and you bring up a good point, too, about knowing all the lyrics and all of that. The thing here is another point that I don't think people speak enough about or realize, really. We've sort of put all this information in our head. And with me, it was pornography for 20 years. People don't understand the psychological damage that's been done as a result to having, you know, allowed myself to see all those images. It, you know, I'm converted, you know, I got on my knees and I let go and I let God. And in that moment, I experienced a mystical, encounter with God. He turned me on to God in that very instant. But I tell you, you know, it doesn't go away. It doesn't like, he's not like he wiped the hard drive and rebooted, you know, he didn't reinstall the operating system in my mind. That's not the way it works. You know, that's the people don't understand the downside to sin. The effect of sin is the sin itself. As a result
right.
of living all that sin, I now have all this garbage in my brain that's ready and willing to come out at a moment's notice, that's triggered by the slightest little things. I could be sitting at Mass, listening to a homily, hear the priest mention something that will trigger something else that will trigger an image.
Right.
People don't understand how damaging that is. I now have to live the rest of my life bearing that cross. I have to confront every single one of those temptations, and I have to pray. Personally, this is how I get through it. I pray to our Blessed Mother and ask her to help me get through that encounter. And if usually it lasts seconds, because once I start praying to our Blessed Lady, they go right away. But people don't understand that that's an exercise, much like an alcoholic has to wake up every day and say, I'm not drinking, or go through every moment of that day and say, I will not drink. You know, it's a cross that we now have to bear until we're dead. And it's the same thing with this rap music. It's in your brain. There's no getting rid of it. You now have to fight that battle every single day of not letting that come back to the forefront, not letting that influence your thought and spending even a minute pondering upon that lyrics again. It's the same thing. People just don't understand the damaging effects of that.
You know, the great hope that we can take is is just in knowing that we're not the first to have struggled with these issues. You know, two in particular that I always hark to. Matter of fact, I quote in my book Saint Augustine, who talks about just how challenging it was after becoming a Christian, basically hearing these voices in his head of all, you know, of just women saying, you know, are you really going to be a Christian and not be with us forever?
Right.
You know, something to that effect. I don't have the quote in front of me, but that is, you know, the challenge of those who are addicted to pornography. When you make that break, you know, you are, you know, it's like these voices in your head are constantly beckoning you to come back to that vice. And, you know, St. Paul is another one, not with sexuality, but, you know, St. Paul was involved in the murder of St. Stephen, and,
right.
and I would have to believe that, you know, that image haunted him the rest of his life as
right.
well.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, that you're right. It is a great challenge, and especially today too, Joe. I don't care, you know, what group of guys you're involved with, whether it's in the Marine Corps or it's on college campus or it's a sports team or whatever. Pornography comes up.
Right.
You know, guys and pornography, they go hand in hand nowadays. And, you know, it's not just, you know, a peep show type thing. Now we're dealing with really diabolical things like sadomasochism and bestiality. The
right.
images that young men are seeing of, you know, women with animals and, you know, I hate to say it, I mean, women with fecal matter and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so diabolical and so disordered and disgusting
right.
that you're right. I mean, these are images that are never going to go away.
And it just gets more and more perverse. There's, it's the same thing when you start to talk about, you know, when you came into the professional world and you realized there was no saturation point. You wanted six figures, you got six figures. Well, you want that high, that dopamine rush in your brain, you want that? Well, you get it, but again, it's not satisfying, is it? You need it again, but you need it longer, you need it better. It needs to be, you know, more and more perverse. So these men go down a vortex. They're just being sucked further and further down, and their appetites get more and more grotesque. And people don't realize that this is now an addiction that needs to be nipped in the bud early, and men need to have accountability for it. It's not unlike being an alcoholic. It's very much like being an alcoholic. I mean, people have to be held accountable. It was a process for my wife and I that had to have to go through this. You know, when I was coming out of all this, my wife had to hold me accountable for my actions. I couldn't be on the internet by myself. That's not something that could happen. And it was hard. It was hard to go through that accountability. But these are the things that happen when we have, you know, submitted ourselves to pornography, you know, inappropriate music, whether it's rap or even rock and roll or anything. It doesn't make much difference. The fact is that we have done massive psychological damage to ourselves, and now as we understand that, we now have to fight that battle every day, and it has to. We can't slack on it, because it'll get the better of us. But thank God we have the sacrament of reconciliation, or else we'd all be in trouble.
That's right.
You know, the only other point that I wanted to make about the rap music was, you know, when reading this book and thinking about these things out of my own life experience, it never ceases to fail me how the non-believer who's fully, you know, in the middle of all this life, in the middle of that culture, the rap music culture, how come they never ask themselves that the songs are always the same? They're never about anything. It's always about women and money and what they think of success, or their power over another person. They never have any depth. They're never about anything. And it never ceases to amaze me that there's a new rap artist who's made $1 million doing the same thing everybody else has done. I mean, they're being fed the same old thing every single time, and nobody stops to say, well, shouldn't we get something different?
Well, as Christ says in the Bible, I mean, where your treasure is, there your heart is also. And it's, you know, clearly their treasure is in money and in women, and so it you know, it's very easy and understandable to see why, you know, all of their songs are about those things. That's where their heart is. But, you know, I'll say this, Joe, that just in hearing you speak about the book, one of the things that, you know, I love so much in you know, talking about the book with you, is that you're not a guy in your 20s, and yet you were able to get a lot out of this book. And you know, I think that's what you know, I'm hoping that, you know, a lot of people are, you know, similar to you, are able to, you know, look at the story and not only reflect on their own past, but for moms who are trying to raise young sons, this may be the book they need to read to understand
right.
what's going on in the guy, in the head of a guy, or women in their 20s who want to know what's going on in the heads of their boyfriends or fiancés or husbands. This is a book that they need to read. And so, you know, this is a book about men in their 20s, but it's not a book exclusively for men in their 20s. And,
right.
and you know, I hope people, you know, embrace it with that mindset.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on with the book now. We see this, like I said, this earlier, this phase where you're cleaning yourself out, you're taking an account of everything, you're throwing away those magazines, you're monitoring what you know, what television and music that you're intaking. You're starting to read, you know, Fulton Sheen, and you're starting to discover your faith. But yet, we have this scene where you're in an airport restaurant waiting for a flight, and you discover for yourself that you're so quickly sucked into pop culture once again, and you realize for yourself that where is your priority? How do you prioritize your faith in everything else you're doing? And you realize this because you had this conversation with this guy who's just intent on bringing you in. He's not letting you go. He is not going to let you sit there and read your book. He wants you to talk about sports. I mean, I have to believe that this was heavenly inspired, you know, that this guy was there for a purpose, you know, to help you in your conversion experience. And I'm going to call it that anyway. I mean, you realize you know more about sports than you do your own faith. And this, again, because of my professional experience in the logistics community, you know, I have you know, power lunches, meetings all the time with road warriors like you. And yeah. So I know the kind of guy that you were, and I can fully appreciate this scene. So let's talk about that for a second. What were you thinking? I could really sense that you didn't want to be a part of that, but you also couldn't help yourself.
Well, first of all, one of the things that I do often in the book is I try to set up distinctions, two things happening at the same time that are in total opposition to each other.
Right.
In this case, it was reading Fulton J. Sheen and his words on the marks of true education and, you know, being distracted by the television and sports and, you know, the Oscars that were coming up and such. And I do the same thing, you know, in the club with the rap music and then thinking about, you know, my faith and such. Well, you know, this conversation with, I think it's Frank and Sal, you know, we're talking about the Red Sox. The Red Sox just won the World Series. I've always been just a passionate sports fan, all major sports. And I know everything about what's going on, not only on the field, but the transactions that are taking place off the field in the off season with the minor leaguers that are up and coming. And we're having this long, involved conversation about sports and batting averages and salaries and all this stuff. And, you know, I think if you poll 80% of the men in the United States, they could all have similar conversations about their favorite sports teams. 94 million people watched the Super Bowl, you know, last week. So, you know, clearly sports is an important part of our culture. And the whole point that I'm trying to make in this chapter is sports are great, right? They're a nice form of healthy recreation. We need recreation in our lives to help us get to heaven. We need time to decompress.
Right.
We need time to release our masculine energy in a way that's healthy and competitive. But we have a sports addiction in this country, not just sports, but television and movies and such, that really takes the place of true education in our lives. I mean, I have a line in the chapter that says that, you know, the fact is that our time is an investment, and time spent on sports is cashed and spent without any hope of subsequent dividends.
Mm.
And we need to look at it that way. How much time do we spend on sports compared to time that we spend learning about our faith?
Right.
I mean, I'm inclined to believe it's 100-1 for most men. And or time that we spend on sports versus time that we spend in prayer. Minimum 10-1, right?
Right.
And when we look at that in terms of the opening sentence in the book, success in life and business begins by focusing on death, we have to ask ourselves the question, is this contributing to you know, my eternal salvation? Is all of this time I'm spending on sports, is this helping me get to heaven?
Right.
And the answer is no, it's not. And you know, you'll see in the first half of that chapter, I'm having this intense dialogue on sports I know everything about. And then the second half of the chapter is this conversation with Janice on the plane. And Janice is just a woman in her mid-30s who is, you know, another road warrior in business, wearing the business suit and the whole bit. And we have this religious conversation. She is, you know, someone who loves Don Miguel Ruiz and the Toltec tradition. And obviously I'm a Catholic, and we're having this religious conversation. And I clearly do not know as much about my faith as I do about sports. And that is singularly a major problem. The whole point of that chapter is to say, we need to focus on our education. We need to know the story about Galileo. We need to know what happened in the Inquisition and the Crusades. We need to know our catechism through and through. Do we know that, or do we know more about sports? That's the argument that I'm presenting there.
You know, when I read that exchange with you and Janice on the plane, I got what you were telling me about, you know, that if you really realized your own priority in it, the sports, although it's a good, because when God created the world, he created everything good. So there is good in sports and athletic events and knowledge of those things. Absolutely. But it doesn't contribute to your salvation. So it's disorder to put too much emphasis on them. And I agree with that point. But at the same time, I thought you had a pretty good exchange with Janice. I thought you did a pretty good job of dealing with her, because I don't think, honestly, I would have done as well with her as probably you did at that time in your life. And I'm not trying to say that I have any better knowledge of Catholicism than you do. All I'm saying is, because of our styles, I thought that your style with her was useful from a sense that she probably heard things that she had never heard in a way that she's never heard it before. She's probably more used to guys like me who will just spit out some quote or some verse or some historical fact that she'll just ignore and shut down and move on. You know what I mean?
Right.
I totally agree that I thought, you know, it was a great point to say, you know, we have to have the right perspective on our faith. And I try to encourage everybody, learn your faith, learn something new today. You do, and especially as Catholics, and you made this point just a few minutes ago, as Catholics, we get it from all sides. We can't have a straight apples-to-apples debate with anybody, because we'll have, like, if we're talking about, just the other day, I was having a conversation with somebody about life and abortion, and although we're having this topic about abortion, they want to throw a curveball at me about some pope from centuries ago who did some horrible thing. Okay, well, are we talking about abortion, or are we talking about that pope? I can speak to that issue, but, I mean, you've sort of changed the subject. And I think Catholics get it that way. You know, we'll talk about something, then all of a sudden, yeah, but you guys believe in purgatory. Okay, let's talk about purgatory. You know, and so I really enjoyed this exchange that you had with her on the plane. I honestly thought you did a good job. I got the sense from the book that you felt you didn't do as good a job as you had, and maybe because the results weren't readily apparent. But I have to believe that this woman lies in bed at night looking up at the ceiling thinking about what you told her.
Yeah. Well, I would hope so. You know, I tried to do two things simultaneously in that conversation alone, which is, one, for the reader, I want to allow the reader to arrive at Christianity logically, which is the point that, you know, the point of that conversation is to, you know, discuss, you know, praying to the saints, how that's a logical thing to do.
Right.
Or, you know, discuss why it's logical to focus on death, let's say. And she is making this counter argument. I think the distinction between the sports section and that conversation is one really of language. And when we talk about sports, at least when I speak about sports in front of my wife, she can't understand half of the words that I'm saying. Line of scrimmage. What is line of scrimmage? My wife has no idea, you know?
Right.
You know, RBIs or OPS, you know, all the different acronyms that we use in baseball.
Right.
My wife has no idea. The same can be said of our faith. I mean, we have a lot of words that we use in our faith that most people would have no clue about. Let's say a monstrance. Mm. You know, what is a monstrance? You ask most Catholics. I would venture to say 90% of Catholics today have no idea what a monstrance is. This is kind of a basic thing, you know.
Right.
And so the distinction that I'm making in that conversation with Janice is that, you know, I have at that point already arrived at my Catholicity. I already understand it from a logical perspective. It makes a lot of sense. I'm making the right changes. I'm reading a lot to help infuse my knowledge. But, you know, at the same time, I still don't know the language very well. I'm still fumbling around for words. I'm still trying to find my way through having a religious argument. And so the point that I'm making to the reader is, you know, look, you know, I understand my faith. I'm getting to that point, but there's still so much I need to learn, particularly when I compare it to my knowledge of sports.
Right.
So if I can at least bring up my religious knowledge to the level that I have level of knowledge I have in sports, and I'll be doing okay. Mm-hmm. I make the point in the chapter, look, when I was playing Trivial Pursuit, I was strictly looking for the green wedge, right? Because, you know, the green wedge is a sports question. So I get 9 out of 10 of those right. If they had a purple wedge for religion, my gosh, how many of those questions would I get right? Who knows, you know, at that point. So, you know, I wanted to, you know, represent what that conversation was like and, you know, make some logical points of fact, particularly for, you know, other Christians who may not think Catholicism is, you know, 100% true. I wanted to make some logical points while at the same time presenting that I don't know everything, or at least at that time I didn't know as much as I needed to know.
You know, and I was reading that and thinking back on certain conversations I've had with certain people, and there's, you know, that atheist in college that I was debating, then there's been, you know, good Baptist neighbors of mine who wanted me to become Baptist and leave the Catholic Church. And at both of those points in my life, I didn't really know about my faith. I couldn't defend the church's position on the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. I couldn't defend, you know, divinely inspired creation, you know, to this atheist. I just didn't have that knowledge. But in both instances, I walked away saying, I'm not going to be caught like a deer in the headlights again. I'm going to go and study. And I did. I poured myself into, you know, the study of those topics. So the very next time I encountered someone like that, I was going to be prepared. I would have the answer. It might not be a polished, perfect answer, but I'm not going to sit there and go, I don't know. I don't know where the church gets off talking about, you know, the how Mary was born without sin. I have no idea where that's in the Bible. You know, I wasn't going to be that guy, you know, and so it was more of a personal drive, you know, and so I would study and study and study. So I sort of got that sense out of this conversation you had with Janice, is that although you felt, like you say, you arrived at your Catholicism and you believed in it, but I got that, I sort of related to, I could feel like you were, like just like I did, that you were going to go walk away, and the next time you had that conversation, you were going to be far better prepared.
Absolutely. And, you know, in business, I'll tell you this, Joe, that, you know, I would go into every single business meeting, whether that was in the U.S. or Japan or anywhere else, and I would know ahead of time the questions that were going to be asked of me. I would know. The questions were always the same, particularly as it related to the parts, but also in relating to, you know, the business flow. And I would have the answers, you know, almost memorized to a certain degree because I would repeat them so much. And I think the same is true when we have conversations with atheists or, you know, with members of other religions. The questions are always the same. Their arguments are always the same.
Right.
And it just comes down to having the Catholic response on the top of your, you know, on the top of your head.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, at this point, particularly in, you know, in my travels with speaking, I get the same questions over and over again too, and it's, you know, it's gotten to the point where I have quick responses for them just because I'm so used to it. I think one person who does this particularly well is a guest that you had on not too long ago, John Martinoni.
Mm.
You know, when he talks about his debates with Protestants, he always knows the quotes from the Bible that they're going to bring up. He knows
right.
the questions that they're going to ask, and he has answers for them readily on the tip of his tongue. So. Mm. You know, that's how we have to approach it.
Right. And again, I don't think we have to be experts at it. We don't have to have the whole argument memorized. We don't have to have read Aquinas' Summa Theologica, you know, to have that response. And oftentimes, if we just give a response that sounds logical and reasonable, well, we've done something that no other Catholic in that person's life has ever done.
That's right. And then they'll immediately change the subject.
Exactly. Yeah, but you guys believe in purgatory. You know, so yeah, we get it all the time. And that's
you had a bad pope once.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but you people are evil, you know. Yeah, we get it from all different directions. And that's what makes it hard to be Catholic. Catholicism is advanced, for sure. It's not that surface level, you know, faith. You know, we have to be intelligent and thinking. And, you know, although there's plenty of good Catholics who are just faithful and they take it on faith, but if we're going to engage in discussion with other people who aren't of our faith, we really need to be, you know, thinking about these things. And what I really love about our faith is we never have to be afraid of the truth. We seek truth. So if someone says something to us that stymies us, well, we just go and study and dive deep and dig into it, and we'll come out more Catholic than we were before. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
So, okay, what did you take away from your conversation with Janice? I mean, you seem frustrated at the end of it, and what direction did it take you in?
Well, more than anything, what it caused me to do is learn my faith even better than I had known it before. I'm one of those people. I've always struggled with pride, Joe. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, I'm the type of guy, you know, I want to have the last word in sports. I hate losing. I don't like losing checkers to my 8-year-old cousin. You know, I'm just that type of guy. And
you hated the Super Bowl then, huh?
Oh man, it was tough being a Pats fan. It was real tough.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
You know, it's one of those things where, you know, I hate that feeling of not being able to have the right response or the quick response. And in business, I think, you know, it was one of the reasons why I was successful at an early age is that I worked very diligently at being able to communicate ideas very well. And so more than anything, I kind of came out of that conversation with her saying, look, I need to know a lot more about my faith. And what happens is, you know, the more that you know, the more the challenges laid before you, because, you know, I'll say, gosh, you know, I wanted to learn more about my faith, so I read Introduction to a Devout Life. Well, I read Introduction to a Devout Life, and I realize just how much further I needed to go to become a better Christian, to become a better Catholic.
Right.
And that influenced other phases of my life. And so you see in the book, you know, I come out of that, you know, conversation with Janice, and, you know, I end up coming back home and really saying, well, look, one of the biggest changes I need to make is instead of waking up every morning to go to the gym for my own vanity, one of the things that I really need to focus on is getting to daily mass. And so I made the switch. You know, I switched, instead of going to the gym in the morning, I went to daily mass in the morning. And, you know, that's when you start getting into the what ultimately is my favorite chapter in the book, chapter 11, you know, the chapter on sacrifice. And just how difficult it is to really live the kind of the true Catholic way of life in our culture today, and how necessary it is to make sacrifices in order to arrive at that end goal. But, you know, that is all a byproduct of learning more and more about my faith, because it's very easy to sit back and say, well, you know, a good Christian is one who is good to people and goes to church, you know. And for so many years, I kind of had that mindset. And, you know, in reading the books from the saints, it is so much more than that.
Right.
You know, it is so much more than that. Our life has to be a constant dialogue with God. We're no longer in the Garden of Eden where, you know, we may hear God's voice like you and me talking. But,
right,
you know, from the moment that we wake up in the morning to the moment that we go to bed at night, our life is a journey back to God. He wants us, and it's why we have our, you know, our innate desire for truth, beauty, and goodness. It's from the moment that we're born, we're on a journey back to Him. And how often do we wake up and, you know, we don't say morning prayers, and we just kind of, you know, hop in the car, drink our coffee, go to work, and, you know, we're wrapped up in all the secular things of the world. And you know, that was kind of the big turning point, is turning every single moment, every second of my life into a prayer to God, a communication, a dialogue with God. And quite frankly, I mean, that is a very, very difficult thing to do. I mean, I struggle with that daily, you know, now, and I'm sure I'll struggle with it till the day that I die.
Right.
But at least I know what I'm working towards, and I get better and better at it as the years go by.
There you have it, Tarek Saab, Gut Check. Stick around. That coming up next will be the conclusion of this conversation with Tarek Saab about this great book. I hope you're enjoying it, and if you want to pick up a copy, you can do that right off of my blog, www.catholichack.com. Right on the top, there's a banner that says Buy Gut Check, or you can just go right to the site, buygutcheck.com. But by buying it off the blog, you support me, and I do appreciate that. So please do stop by. Tonight, you know, I've been well blessed. A listener to the podcast has written in and wanted to support this podcast by making a donation. So what she has done is she has now purchased 10 Catholic Hack t-shirts as a way to support the podcast. You know, and I cannot say thank you enough. That really touched me, and I'm so thankful for that. So God bless you for your support. And what she's asked me to do is to give these Catholic Hack t-shirts away. So we're going to use these as giveaways here on the podcast. So praise God. Thank you so much for your generosity. So Catholic Hackers, we're going to go on a diving expedition. That's right. I want to hear from you. I want you to send me some voicemail. I want to know from you, why does my Catholic Bible have 7 more books than my Protestant father's Bible? That's right. I want to hear from you right now. Give me a call on the voicemail feedback line, 713-568-6277. That's 713-568-6277. I'll take the first call who can tell me where in the Bible does Jesus quote from the 7 books that are in question. Where in the early church history can we determine whether or not these 7 books were accepted by the first Christians, and where the Protestants decided that they were going to go away, that they weren't going to be a part of their canon? Did the Catholic Church add them, or did the Protestants take them away? That's your challenge. And the first caller at 713-568-6277 to give me the answer will get a free Catholic Hack t-shirt. So dive deep and give me a response today, because I want to know from you where we go wrong, where we go right. As certified scripture divers, we must always be prepared, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that lies within. That's 1 Peter 3:15. Have you left a review on iTunes today for the Catholic Hack? If not, please do so. We've got about 56 reviews. And we're always looking for more. We're about halfway up the second page of the featured Christian podcast list on the iTunes web store, and I want to make it onto the first page. And we can do that with your help, so please do that today. Be sure also to stop by the Catholic Hack bookstore at www.catholiccompany.com/Catholic Hack. And that's how you can also support this podcast. Well, until next time, I pray that God richly bless you. God bless.
SQPN, the best in Catholic podcasting.